My name is Dan Barrett. You're listening to the Oz Media Report. This week on the Oz Media Report, we're talking about streaming services. How much do you know about TV from Africa? I know next to nothing, and I reckon it's safe to say that you don't know that much either. There's a new streaming service that's set to change that. It's called Demand Africa. While the service is US-based, run by traditional cable outfit The Africa Channel, Demand Africa has quietly launched in Australia, streaming both a free linear channel and subscription video on demand content through its app, available on Apple TV, Samsung TVs, iOS, and Android. The service caught my interest, so I had a chat with Narendra Reddy. He's the Vice President and General Manager of the service, and also Dean Cates, who's the exec in charge of Demand Africa. But my interest in streaming TV doesn't end there. This week on the podcast, we're also talking to Samantha Laidlaw. She's the head of a new local streaming service called Femflix. They are aiming to stream movies that are either driven by female-identified creatives, or they have strong themes or storylines related to women. Both are really interesting chats about streaming services that have a very clear purpose. First, let's go to my chat with the team behind Demand Africa. Narendra, Dean, thank you very much for joining us on the Oz Media Report.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so I stumbled across Demand Africa. I was doing a little bit of overseas television tourism, I guess we'll call it, and I stumbled across the linear channel of Demand Africa on Pluto TV. I thought this is kind of interesting. I found myself watching it for about 4 or 5 hours straight. Like, it was content I was unfamiliar with. I didn't really quite know exactly what I was watching, but it was captivating. I was very into it. And then I was playing around my phone. I thought, Demand Africa, I wonder if they've launched in Australia. Lo and behold, found the app. So you guys clearly have a global footprint that you're slowly sort of rolling out. So I thought I'd get you on the line, talk to you about your plans for Demand Africa, what the service is, where you're taking it going forward. So maybe we just start with the sort of basis of it. What's the origins of Demand Africa? How long has it been running for? Where's it available? Like, what's the broader scope of it?
Sure.
So I can just start a little bit with before we get into the specifics of Demand Africa, sort of the parent company that originated Demand Africa, and then I'll turn it over to Dean to speak a little bit more specifically about the Demand Africa product. So the Demand Africa is part of a group of companies that are called the Africa Channel, and we have principally been a cable operator in the United States to present contemporary narratives of Africa to North American audiences. So we wanted to change the narrative that CNN and other major networks would present, which is just basically sensational news or strife, or on the other end of the spectrum, just safaris and sunsets. And we all recognize there are 54 countries with vibrant cultures, and none of those stories were making it to North American shores. So the company was started about 18 years ago, and we were primarily been operating as a cable platform, as a cable company for all these years. And more recently, in the last 4 years, we realized that the product that we had was relevant for audiences in other parts of the world, as well as in areas of the United States where the Africa Channel wasn't carried. And so we actually launched a new product, Demand Africa, and I'll turn it over to Dean to speak a little bit more about that.
Sure. So Demand Africa was sort of an extension of that mission of bridging cultures and sort of bringing the unseen side of positive stories from Africa into the US. And we realized that with the immigration worldwide, that there was a gap, you know, outside of Africa. So Demand Africa was more of our digital extension, our digital extension of that mission. So we launched it on the web, on Roku, on iOS and Android, as well as Amazon Fire, first as a subscription video on demand platform. And we had some pretty good success promoting that here in the States, and just getting subscribers from the randomest of places, from Sweden to Asia to a few in Australia. And then we recently launched a linear channel also called Demand Africa, which is ad supported, so it's free. So we thought that would be a good vehicle to kind of introduce people to the content who may not have as much experience with it and maybe weren't ready to kind of subscribe full time to a subscription based VOD platform.
Yeah.
So in Australia, we should be available via Android, the web, and iOS. And I don't know if Roku is fully rolled out in Australia or how available Amazon Fire TV is there.
Amazon Fire TV, you can get around the place. Roku haven't got a branded Roku box in Australia. Instead, there's a local telco. It's called Telstra. And so they've rebranded as the Telstra TV. But it's Roku, okay. But you can't necessarily get third-party apps in the way that you can with Roku in the US.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that sort of helped us get this venture launched was our ability to curate the best of what was available across the continent and combine that with original content that we've been creating over the years. We found that there was really no captive platform for African-oriented content in any parts of the world. US Black content is very much content that's been created here for African-American audiences. It has some relevance to Africans, but not specifically so. And so we felt that there could be the opportunity to create a brand, a worldwide brand, that specifically met the needs of over 150 million people of the African diaspora who have decided to make the world their home. And so with that, we, as Dean mentioned, us being able to launch a free ad-supported television platform allowed us to introduce this content to markets where heretofore we would not assume that people would be interested in this content. And I think one of the things that Netflix has done, just made it easier for our content to be accepted in other parts of the world, is you know that people are being introduced to content from all kinds of cultures on Netflix. And some of the biggest shows on Netflix are non-English based content from shows like Narcos to Fauda, the Israeli show, and all are getting resonating with audiences. And we really do think it's time for African-oriented content to reach audiences. And Australia is one of the other thing about our content is it's mostly in English. So one of our initial strategies was to find all the key English-speaking markets to present our content to. So in addition to the UK, Australia, and we're currently looking at India as well. And in those conversations, we've started garnering some interest from, I think Samsung TV is launching their Samsung Plus application sometime later this year. And we've been in conversations with them about carrying our FAST channel in Australia on their platform as well.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So in Australia, we've got a TV network here called SBS, and SBS broadcast a lot of foreign language TV drama and have been doing so for the last, I think, 40 years now. I used to work for them just for a bit of clarity on that. So what I found interesting is that SBS have such a strong role in the Australian media landscape, but watching SBS, I can't really think that many times that I've seen programs coming from Africa on SBS. Like, I'm sure there's been a handful over the years, but it's certainly content that I've not been exposed to at all. So when I came across Demand Africa, suddenly it was just like light bulbs went off saying, why have I not seen any of this content? I'm not familiar with any of the content coming from Africa. It is a complete blank slate. So I guess maybe through a period of discovery as to what's going on there. So I guess maybe the question I have about the content on Demand Africa is how reflective is it of TV broadly across Africa? And also, Africa is a pretty big continent. There's a lot of cultures. There's so much variation in what's happening across the content. How do you reflect that in a programming as well?
So interesting enough, you mentioned SBS. SBS actually has licensed a couple of the shows that we've produced, including a show called Africa on a Plate, which is a cooking show that sort of has a chef traveling around Africa presenting different cuisines across Africa. So I think, and that happened recently. So there's been an appetite, it seems, for that type of content. You're absolutely right about the fact that Africa is such a diverse continent that to say something is African content is the equivalent of saying something is European content, because it could mean anything, right? So, but the majority of content that we would consider of the quality that can be broadcast on international platforms typically emanates from about four regions in Africa: South Africa, Kenya, Eastern Africa, as in Kenya, Ethiopia, Western Africa, obviously Nigeria, which is a huge, huge source of content, Nigeria and Ghana, and then sporadically in some of the Northern African countries. Majority of the content that we have on our platforms comes from these three regions: South Africa, Western Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, and Kenya. Increasingly, what we've also been doing is developing a lot of content. One of the things that is missing is truly content that is Pan-African in perspective. And we found that, you know, there are certain genres of content that tend to travel across the continent more easily than others. Sports obviously is a big genre, but we at the moment don't have sports on our platforms. News does, and then we've also increasingly found that lifestyle programming, much of our content is lifestyle, be it music, fashion, food, those kinds of things also tend to travel not just across the continent but internationally as well. And so In for a large portion of our content, we have focused it primarily on more lifestyle, travel, and culture type of content. Though gradually we're introducing content that is outside of those genres that reflect the diaspora experience. And as we are starting to grow, we're starting to develop content that is specifically for the African diaspora, people who we're from Africa, but that reside in other parts of the world. An example is most recently, we did a show called Ama Knows Best, which is basically about a South African rapper who goes to China to learn cooking from Chinese grandmothers.
Yeah.
Essentially taking a fish out of water syndrome. And it was a delightful show, came out really well, has been doing very well for us. And we're starting to take it out onto the world stage in terms of selling the content, and we're finding a lot of interest in that type of content.
So obviously, if you've been focusing largely on lifestyle programming, the thing that you'd probably find a lot of streamers say is that the one thing that moves subscriptions is probably dramas and comedies, and then people may also come across to reality stuff. And while they may be watching that stuff on platform more than dramas, it's the dramas that sell the subscription. So obviously you've got a subscription model in place. Are you now pushing more into scripted to try to drive the subscriptions? Is that generally the approach that's been happening here?
So the free platform tends to be more lifestyle oriented, and you're right, on the subscription platforms that tends to be driven much more by scripted content. And so on our subscription platform, we have a plethora of scripted content, from soaps to drama series, and we're starting to develop our own original series as well to sustain the SVOD platform. But the free platform is primarily driven by lifestyle content with a sprinkling of scripted content just to whet people's appetite, so that if there is a greater interest in that, we would direct them to the SVOD offering. Dean, I don't know if you wanted to add something to that.
No, yeah, on SVOD, our consumption tends to heavily kind of lean towards the long running sort of telenovelas and the soaps and some of the scripted series that we have, to your point. Yeah, that's what drives subscriptions. On the lifestyle side of it, I think what we sort of value in that is increasingly sort of presenting that different worldview of Africa to kind of offset some of the stereotypes that may have been presented. I think the lifestyle does a really good job of that. So increasingly getting people on the SVOD, getting them to subscribe to something like a Battleground or The Wild, and then nudging them into some of the different regions, lifestyle content is sort of the goal there. But on the free TV, opening it up, making it as palatable and sort of inclusive as possible for not just African Americans or diaspora audiences, but also global citizens, and kind of changing people's sort of perspectives on the culture and how they look at and view Africa in general.
Yeah, now you did name some of the programming. If I'm looking at Demand Africa for the first time, I don't really quite know where to start. What's the two or three shows you'd probably recommend people sort of check out and then dive a bit further in after that?
It kind of depends on what you're into. If you're looking for like soapy dramas, Battleground is really popular. We're going to be launching The Wild on the platform here this month or early into 2021. That's a really good series. There's Lockdown, which is coming. It's a South African drama that should be launching soon. That's a great show. On the lifestyle side, like Narendra was saying, Africana Plate, there's a series called Date My Family, which is kind of interesting, where instead of going on a date one-on-one, you actually go on a date with the prospective person's family. So it's kind of an interesting twist on a dating program. Am I missing anything that is pretty popular or interesting in terms of
worldwide, Nate? I mean, a lot of our shows is we try to find accessible points and to the continent. For example, we have a show called Worldwide Nate, which is about a Chicago native Chicago blogger who goes around Africa doing extreme adventures. So we have a way of bringing in audiences into Africa through sort of an unconventional way. And through that, they learn different aspects of different culture. He tries to compete with the Maasai tribe. He thinks of himself, this guy is arguably a bodybuilder, and he thinks he has all the strength in the world. And he goes and tries to race these puny people in the Maasai tribe. And he's barely out of the starting line and they're at the finish line. So it's, so there's a lot of comedy that we try to introduce. Increasingly, we have a lot of stuff in our development slate that is really looking at how do we introduce and sort of break down barriers between cultures through more scripted content. And we're hoping that in the next year, you'll see a lot more of that being offered on our platforms.
Yeah. What I'm kind of interested in is you were talking about the fact you are developing and producing your own content. Is it difficult licensing original shows that like pre-existing programs from across Africa? Or is the idea of developing this stuff so that you own things so you can grow the business and develop things for it further?
No, it's actually just the opposite. Licensing is relatively easy because there aren't very many outlets for... Typically, our strategy has been to exclude Africa from our business at the moment, because we figure there's enough internal platforms that are competing with each other, but nobody's really looking at the world outside of Africa. Mm. And so when we go to all the major producers and distributors to license their content, it's relatively easy for a company like ours to make effective deals with them, because this is found money for a lot of these folks. The reason we had to go into original content is, A, the content that is being developed is sometimes can be hyper-local. The stories are good, but the aesthetic is not one that is still at a level that is globally palatable. Mm. And more importantly for us, we have to find content that reflects the diaspora experience. So for Africans who've made England their home, they would like to see as much about what happens in a part of London as they would in Africa. So we have to build in those types of sensibilities. And so much like the success of shows in the US like Blackish, which represents the African-American experience, we do have to incorporate those types of things, and those are not readily available. And so we've started developing those with writers and artists who have made these different countries their home.
Now, for the distribution of the, I'm thinking about the linear channel here more than anything else. You've got Demand Africa on Pluto TV in the US. Are you planning to try to get that linear service? Because obviously the linear service will be the thing that really drives the brand and raise awareness of it. Is the plan is to try to get that onto other similar linear fast services like Pluto TV? And I'm thinking about Pluto, like they're launching internationally. So I think early 2021, they've got plans to launch in Spain and France. Are you in conversations with them about taking your channel as part of like their rollout as they push forward?
Yeah. So in the US so far, we've launched on Xumo, which is, I think, targeting more of a Latin America approach to the rollout. We're working on making the SVOD available on Roku in their premium channel. And with Pluto, we have the deal we have in place with Pluto is as they expand, they can bring our channel along with them. So it really, a lot of it is just kind of educating these platforms on the value of African content. I mean, to the point, sure. Your point is there's a lot of unfamiliarity with that Africa One even produces content that to Nigeria is one of the largest film producing hubs in the world. So a lot of it is just as they grow, kind of convincing them of the value of Demand Africa and the need for it in, you know, in somewhere like Spain, where I think they have about 1 million immigrants living in Spain and Italy, and Germany. And as we grow, kind of figuring out ways to subtitle and dub the content into local languages to kind of help people sort of connect with the content more. I mean, one of our main goals was kind of to create an engine where within Africa.
Can you talk about the Brazil and Mexico launches?
Oh yeah, so we are looking at launching in Brazil and Mexico here in January and February via Samsung. So we're really trying to figure out who's going into what market and who can we partner with to help carry the channel into those markets. So Samsung is launching in India. They're just launched in Australia. So there's a little bit of back and forth and convincing. But I think even Samsung identified that in Australia, there is a gap in this kind of programming and there is a need for it. So I'm hoping that, you know, we'll be on Samsung in Australia here in the next 3 to 6 months.
The biggest issue we have is discoverability. So yeah. So in terms of distributing our FAST channel, we have to be carried on platforms where they're readily available, like Samsung. Pluto is not in Australia as yet, is it?
No, but there's so Viacom CBS own one of the main broadcast channels here. So I would expect that Pluto will launch much sooner than people expect. So they haven't announced anything, but I'm pretty certain it's coming.
So that would be a good thing for us as well. Yeah, because they are very committed to us. They've done very well by us in the US by launching us in their premium tier of entertainment channels. Because I think a lot of these platforms are recognizing the need for inclusion and diversity, not just from an altruistic perspective, but actually from a business perspective as well. I always keep making this claim. 10 years ago in the United States, British content was considered niche. And and if there was any British shows, US developers would always try to remake it for US audiences. Now, Netflix has completely changed that, and every show you see feels like it was made in the UK. So my contention is it perhaps is time for Africa now.
Yeah, so if you're pushing out into other countries, obviously your linear channel carries a lot of US advertising on it. Are you going to be setting up partnerships with local companies to, you know, local advertising sales? Is that kind of on the agenda at this point, or is this really something where you're pushing the brand out first and then you're going to worry about the revenue that can bring in at a later point?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these agreements with like a Samsung, they'll monetize the channel. So a lot of that in specific markets, if they're building the infrastructure to kind of, you know, work with different advertisers in Australia, for instance, across multiple channels, it's a little easier for us to let them sort of take the channel and monetize it and then split revenue back versus us try to take 50% of the inventory or 60% of the inventory and monetize it from our base or build that infrastructure. So a lot of like the new model for linear distribution is really one of more partnership where the platforms themselves are carrying a little bit more of the power and weight in terms of monetization than maybe the old school sort of linear broadcast model, where it was more of a barrier entry to get in, to get a channel up. Now it's more of a barrier to sort of own a piece of the monetization of your channel.
I guess maybe the final thing I was kind of interested in is, I mean, there's lots of things I'm interested in, but the final thing we'll talk about today was specifically, obviously you're buying a lot of content and you're bringing it to an audience which isn't really the intended audience when the show was produced. Are you finding shows that are really quite popular in Africa just aren't really getting the cut through on your platform? Are you surprised at some of the, I guess, viewer interest in programs that may not necessarily be the marquee programs that you've acquired?
I think the part of the reason is not, yes, the answer is there are some programs that don't work very well in Africa and seem to work very well internationally and vice versa. I think there's, for some of the more hyper-local content, the audiences tend to be those who've recently emigrated. So that type of content works well with them. People who are second and third generation immigrants and people who are from here, the more hyper-local content doesn't seem to work, but formats that are recognizable seem to be working very well. The Dean had brought up the show Date My Family, which the format of that show is, people are very familiar to dating formats on TV shows. So it provides an easy access point for somebody to fully get invested in the show, and that show has been received very well, at least in the US where we're currently airing it. But some of the more sort of hyper-local scripted content may or may not resonate broadly, but there's always niche. That's the power of these SVOD platforms is on the SVOD side, as long as we have a sufficient breadth of content, there's always somebody who's going to be interested in a particular type of content that may not necessarily have broad appeal. And because of the deals that we have struck, which are largely revenue share deals that we strike with distributors across the continent, rather than having that content sit in their shelf, by placing it on our platform, they have some way of monetizing it by finding audiences that prior to this have not been interested in that type of content.
Excellent. Guys, I'll let you get on with your day, but thank you very much for letting us know more about the service. It's a breath of fresh air. I'm always excited to find content that I've never really experienced before, and this is an untapped, well of it. Like, this is really awesome to see it rolling out.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Thank you for having us.
I was really surprised by Demand Africa. Watching it made me realize just how little I'd ever seen from Africa. I'd recommend downloading the app and give the linear streaming channel a look. It's free to access, so it's a really good taster to show the sort of thing that you're missing. Now, my second interview this week is with Samantha Laidlaw. She's launched a new streaming service called Femflix. It launched just 6 weeks ago, and the quickest way to describe it is that it's the Netflix of movies about women made by women. There's been a very strong push within the industry to address gender inequality issues within the film and TV industry, and platforms like Femflix are really important to highlight the depth of talent out there producing stories that often don't really get enough mainstream recognition. Samantha Laidlaw, thank you for joining us on the Oz Media Report.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so Sam, I was super intrigued when I came across Femflix because, first of all, it struck me as surprising that nobody had really done this, at least not as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I was sort of looking into it. It's been about 2 years actually in the making. And so back in 2018, I just returned from America after being over there for a couple of years and working in the industry over there. And I did start looking around to see what was available. And we did a lot of research, and even internationally, there's not really a, well-known brand, something that is focused in the way that Femflix is focused, to showcase and shine a light on female storytelling and female-led, female-created storytelling. So, it was a surprise to me as well. I think really the only thing that we found was there was one platform, and I think it's sort of only really started in about the last 12 months, but it's with WIFT International, and I think that they are more focused on promoting the filmmakers to get them into a North American market as opposed to it being a consumer-focused product that's for audiences. So, it really seemed like an opportunity for us to do something really special.
Yeah, because in the last, I'd say 2 years, like pretty much as long as it seems like you've been focused on developing this, it seems that that conversation about wanting to support female directors and actually really not just sort of like sort of playing on that sort of gender idea of like people talking about like Oscars so white and like that conversation happened in terms of people of color. But at that same time, there was a lot of focus saying, well, there's also a lot of dudes just getting up on stage. And so I feel that conversation's really spurred in the last 2 years. But it's been going longer than that. Like, I do think, like, I've heard people really sort of getting quite angry about the situation of the gender inequity within the film system. So it does surprise me that it's only been in the last 2 years that you've started working on this and no one else seems to have done it. It's just, it's such a gap in the market. I just find it highly surprising.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you know, we're talking, it's a niche platform, right? But it's 50% of the population.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a funny thing as well, because it's not like, you know, I love all types of cinema. I go to the movies and watch, you know, action and romance and comedy and, you know, stories about men, stories about women. It's sort of not so much that as, it just seems that it's almost people shy away a little bit from thinking that stories can be just as good and just as remarkable and have such a high excellence, that can be made, directed, written by women, can be about women, you know, is exploring the female journey through cinema. You know, it is surprising to me that it hasn't been done, but I do think that you're right. I think it's become much more prevalent in, you know, as a discussion point in media. And I think kind of off the back of that Me Too movement and Time's Up movement in 2017 and the Harvey Weinstein scandal that happened over in Hollywood, I think all of those things sort of simultaneously happening really kind of forced the point and made it so widespread through media that it just sort of seems like the right time to kind of really do something and have an impact.
Okay, well, let's talk about the film selection on there. So obviously, it's called Femflix. I think the name in itself, everyone probably gets a pretty good idea of what it is. But how do you actually necessarily categorize something as saying, yes, this is appropriate for Femflix when maybe something isn't? Like, what boxes need to be ticked for it to be appropriate?
It's a good question. I mean, for the way that we program, so we have a clear mandate that we express, which is that every piece of content on our platform has to have at least one female identifying person in the role of director, producer, writer, cinematographer, or lead protagonist, which really actually makes it pretty open for us to get a program. But I'd say that if you were to look at some of the films that we have that, for example, may have a male director, more often than not, the reason it's been picked is because it's a very strong female-led story. It would have a female protagonist in it. And more often than not, it may also have a female writer or a female producer as part of that team. So we always look for that first and foremost, because we want that representation behind the camera as well as in front of the camera for the story that gets told. But that's not to say that, you know, I mean, right now, because we're early days, you know, if you went onto the catalogue and had a look, most, if not all, of the stories are actually female content stories. You know, they're about women for women. But I really see that the direction this will go eventually will be that, you know, obviously women tell stories about everything just as men do. So we will get to a point where we can start really leaning into different kinds of programming in terms of storytelling. You know, a perfect example, right, is like Kathryn Bigelow, who's the only woman to have ever won an Oscar. And she won it for The Hurt Locker. So a very male-driven story in a war zone with a male lead protagonist. And she did that exceptionally well. And I would love to see stories that are as diverse as that. But, you know, as long as we are able to meet that sort of core programming requirement, that's how we'll continue to program on Femflix.
Yeah, I mean, Bigelow is a really interesting director in that all of her films are, I'd almost say, hyper-masculine to a certain degree. Even Zero Dark Thirty, which has a very strong female protagonist in it, is such a masculine movie in almost every sense.
Yeah, she's an incredible filmmaker, and you know, it's crazy to think that was how many years ago that she won that, and we still sort of since then haven't really. I think it's like five or six.
Yeah, I want to say 2015.
Nominated.
Yeah, 2015. Yeah. I reckon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time, and that's a systemic issue, right? Like, that's not because there are not women out there who are making exceptional stories that are heartfelt, that are moving, that have action in them. You know, I think I've seen some of those statistics, which are pretty sobering, about independent cinema and the number of women who are represented as directors or storytellers that get to make independent cinema, which is obviously by its very nature usually a low budget kind of project, but it scales very quickly down in terms of the statistics and the percentage of representation of women when it comes to those bigger budgeted studio style films, and that is because of a systemic issue of who's making those decisions at the end of the day.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about Femflix as a platform. When I first heard about it, I assumed you were going down the same route as every other Australian streaming startup, where it's basically a pay-as-you-go model. But you're not. You're really going that Netflix all-you-can-eat. So you pay your subscription fee each month. So first of all, how much does it cost per month? And how many movies do you have on platform?
So we are an $8.99 Australian a month subscription platform, but yep. It's interesting that you sort of compare it to Netflix, because in some ways we are, in terms of its look and its feel, and obviously a 24-hour a day, you know, access platform. But in what we are doing, it's quite different, because one of the pain points that we identified, you know, when we were doing a lot of research, was that I'm sure you've experienced too, is this sense of endless scrolling at night where you can't find what you want to watch. And, you know, it was a very clear issue. And part of that problem is that these large platforms, it's a massive catalog. You know, I think Stan and Netflix and you know, Apple and Amazon, they have over 2,000 titles on these platforms, and that's not what we want for a couple of reasons. One is for the consumer experience, right? So I thought about, what do I want, right? When I look at going onto a platform like this, I want to find something that speaks to me straight away. But I also don't want to go to a platform and have to find something and dig through all of that. Like, part of it is the curation. Part of it is not just curation of what's available on the site, but about what I've been told is on the site. And so a big, big strategy for us is about that really personal curation and having a voice that people can trust. And that's done through all of our guest curation that we're only really just starting to do now. We don't ever really want to have more than 200 titles on the platform at any one time. And that's not just the user experience, but it's also because of our business model. You know, if we are sending revenue back to the content owners, and a big reason of doing this is to try to close that gender pay gap and try to get funds back to the creators of these films. If you are taking a slice of pie that's of, you know, 2,000 odd titles at any one time, you're not getting very much, you know, bang for your buck. We want to be able to actually pass on revenue to the content owners that's meaningful. Otherwise, it's a bit of a pointless exercise, you know. So there's a couple of reasons there that we're quite different to those mainstream kind of Netflixes and Stans.
Yeah, so obviously you got that curation aspect. And I was wondering, is all that curation necessarily happening on platform? Or are you also doing a fair bit of curation through social channels?
I think the community feedback is so important. And I think, it's important no matter what business you're in, right? Especially in today's age where transparency is such a big issue. But I think that for what we're trying to do, and specifically if you think about our core audience, which are predominantly women, women tend to want to have a conversation. You know, that's just in our nature. Like, we like to discuss stuff. We like to get other people's opinions. We want to share. And so we lean into that, right? And that's why we've created the Facebook group page as opposed to just a normal Facebook page. It's why we've got Instagram, which is, you know, probably our strongest space currently. And it's why we're using guest curators. We're using curators from within Femflix as well. We're encouraging our audience to curate and say what they like to watch, because, again, I think it's about viewing habits. You know, I know the way that I go and watch something is usually because I've been told about something to watch. I'm not so much a person who enjoys the experience of discovering for myself as I'm scrolling through, because you tend to go and watch entertainment when, you know, you might be a bit tired, you need a bit of a rest, you want to just be kind of, you want to be entertained, you don't want to be challenged in that moment. And so we want to provide people, you know, the resources so that when they are in that moment of going to watch something, they know what they're about to go and watch. They're going there for a reason. I think it's really, it changes the way that the platform would be used, and hopefully the feedback we're getting, which we are already, says that that's working for people.
Yeah. Now, launching a streaming service from Australia where you've got a limited pool of customers potentially, I don't know if you're geo-blocked or not, I presume that you probably are for licensing reasons. Look, I would say that it's probably, I don't want to use the word foolhardy, but you've suddenly got an uphill climb. So I was wondering, what was it that made you want to launch a streaming service in Australia? Like, it sounds like you were looking for a genre to explore rather than necessarily being driven from the outset by the idea of creating a space for female-driven films. So what was it? Like, why did you want to embark upon this? Like, it's a challenge.
It certainly is a challenge, and certainly a challenge to launch a company in the middle of a pandemic. But
yeah.
I think a couple of reasons. Firstly, we need to test that the product is something that is in demand. So Australia, we're in Australia and in New Zealand. We've launched in both those territories and we are geo-locked. But it's a great testing ground to see how people respond. Is there the demand for the product before trying to scale something internationally? I think secondly, the US market is incredibly saturated. We're going in that direction. You know, the number of streamers that have popped up this year is, it's really exciting, I think. But, you know, it's easier for us as a small company to launch in a country that, you know, we're in, that we know inherently the people here in terms of the content and the distributors. We have those relationships already. It was just a much easier way for us to begin the process of seeing if the product is worthwhile and whether people want it, and then for us to start exploring other territories. And the goal is definitely to scale internationally, but we would do that in a sort of step-by-step process, I would say.
Yeah, I think that female-driven films, because as you mentioned earlier, there's a very strong independent cinema flavor to, I guess, a lot of the films that you would be presenting. That's probably an area of cinema that's not being as heavily dominated by your Amazons and Netflixes of the world. Like, yes, they do have a lot of independent film on both those platforms, but there's still so many other indies that aren't being picked up by them. So I think you've got a good niche there. It's really just... and just think about other platforms. I think that any other genre is being heavily dominated by those platforms. So you're in a sweet spot. So it's a really interesting play you're making. In terms of the technology behind it, I can't imagine that you probably went into it thinking, oh, I'm a tech startup. You really came from it like you're a film industry professional. So you're working backwards into technology. How have you found that? And how did you actually go through the process of finding a platform solution? Because I can't imagine there's that many out-of-the-box solutions you could probably play with.
Yeah, it was your comment's so right. I come from a film and television background. I've been in that for 12, 13 years. So when it comes to content, I know everything about that. When it comes to tech, I didn't start this thinking, oh, I'm going to start a tech company. You know, that was like the furthest thing from my mind. And, you know, lo and behold, you're 2 years down and here we are. It's funny that the journey that I went on in terms of researching technology, understanding how streaming services work, you know, there was a deep, deep tech dive when it came to that. And it's gone through some really interesting iterations. There was a point there for about 12 months that I was looking at building it on the blockchain, and we had a partner in Boston out of MIT, and we were quite far down the path with that, and I'm still incredibly interested in it, and I think that maybe further down the track we may look at redesigning the platform to be built on the blockchain, specifically because I just see that that's where our industry is going in terms of all smart contracts and the way that content is a digital product these days now anyway. So it makes sense that to handle and track data and handle and track the digital files would be a lot easier if it was in a system that worked more seamlessly than it does today. But when it came down to the moment of, well, what, how do we get this into market quickly and how do we do it in a way that sort of works and is not cost prohibitive, that's when we sort of pivoted again and found a white label solution for us that that would work for the time being, I guess, because it's, as I said, you know, we're, what is it, what date is it, you know, we've only been launched for 6 weeks. The point of the platform and how it looks and how it feels right now is just to get it in front of people and to get it out there and to see how people respond to the idea and the brand and what we're presenting in terms of the content itself. So I think this is like iteration one. I would love to see it get to a place, you know, in the next sort of 6 to 12 months where we've shown that there's demand and that there's an audience for this that want to feel like there is a space for them that they feel like they can go to and find content that you know, reflects them. And if we can get there, then I'd say we'd probably be looking at doing a big rebuild of what we're using right now.
Yeah. Just wrapping things up, I guess maybe the question I'm sort of really interested in, and what's the response been from the industry? So obviously there'll be a lot of consumers who have been looking for a product like this, and I'm sure you've heard some very nice things from audiences which have been hungering for this, but just the industry broadly, like what have you heard?
It's been really interesting. Like in some ways, we've had so much support, right? So because I've kind of been talking about it with, you know, in the industry behind the scenes with a lot of people for, you know, 18 months now. So people have known, like certain people have known about it for a long time. And certainly when having all of those conversations with distributors, they've been incredibly supportive because they can see that we're trying to do something that will create real impact and it's good for them, it's good for us. And funnily enough, through a pandemic, you know, when distribution is completely shifted or together, I think it's provided a new business channel for them to, you know, make a different type of revenue. So it's been incredibly positive. I think that certainly female filmmakers in Australia have really got behind it and are excited about it. And I would hope that down the track, you know, once we are a little bit older, once we get through our, you know, toddler and young child days, we'll be able to be in a position where we can actually commission projects, because at the moment we're only licensing stuff that's already completed. I'd love us to get to a place where we can support female filmmakers, we can invest in their stories, we can create original programming, and really kind of make that change, you know, from the beginning, from when they're starting out and they're creating these amazing stories. So, yeah, it's been really exciting to kind of get the support from industry as well as from consumers.
Yeah, look, I'm super interested to see how this really sort of picks up from here. So I'm going to harass you again in about 6 months' time because I want to follow Femflix through.
I would be very happy to come and chat and give you an update. Fingers crossed we'll be around and doing well, and I'll be able to give you a great overview of how everything's been going.
Yeah, let's give people a couple of breadcrumbs so they can follow you along. Femflix, the website is...
just femflix.com. They can go there and join up. We do a 30-day free trial so people can have a go and watch whatever they want. Our social media is always at myfemflix, so they can pop along to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. If they want to join the Facebook group, they can find that as well. It's just Femflix. Let's chat.
Yeah, fantastic. Samantha Laidlaw, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
That's it for the Oz Media Report for another week. Huge thanks to Narendra Reddy and Dean Cates from Demand Africa, and also from Samantha Laidlaw from Femflix. The best way to watch Demand Africa in Australia is via their apps, which you can find on Apple TV, Samsung televisions, iOS, and Android. For Femflix, the best way to access that is currently through the web at www.femflix.com, and that's Femflix with an X. Now, there's no apps for that yet, but the site does support both Chromecast and AirPlay. If you've enjoyed the Oz Media Report podcast, please help out the show. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or hit the share button in your podcast app and post about it on social media. Get it on the Twitter, get it on the Facebook, or email a link of it to a friend or a colleague. Just get the word out there. The more people that listen to the podcast, the stronger the likelihood is of the podcast sticking around. Now, the Oz Media Report is hosted, produced, researched, and casered by me, Dan Barrett. It's a televised Revolution production. We'll be back next week with more of the Oz Media Report. Let's chat then.